At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at Putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Chill, America, and in particular, calm down Wall Street. That was essentially the message from the nation's bank regulators today. In fact, five different federal agencies said in a joint statement that their presumption is the bank should remain in private hands. Do you buy that? Well, we can tell you this, Wall Street still wasn't in a buying mood today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us to start a new week on this 23rd of February. Remember when the bank examiner came calling and It's a Wonderful Life? Multiply that many times over and you'll get a picture of the intense examination the nation's top 20 banking powerhouses are about to face under the guise of something called a bank stress test. And until the results are clearly established, bank regulators can't really know for sure what kind of medicine is actually going to be needed. Notice they signal today that they have no plans to nationalize banks. As our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports, this close look at the books is the first step in the next phase of the government's bank rescue plan.
Just like a doctor making your heart race to find the flaws, a financial stress test subjects banks to increasingly dire economic scenarios to discover where the flow of money breaks down. John Douglas runs the banking practice at the law firm Paul Hastings. He says the regulators will apply hypothetical external shocks to the bank's assets and liabilities.
What happens at various levels of unemployment or various levels of house price declines? What does that do to the financial situation of the banks?
Running the bank's operations through their paces also helps regulators identify hidden liabilities, like offshore accounts or overvalued assets, says Jane Durista with the Financial Markets Center.
We don't know a lot, and we need to know a lot more. How much is off balance sheet now relative to the capital these banks have? And what is on balance sheet, can we get a market price?
That way, regulators can subtract liabilities from assets to see what the banks are worth. And that gives the government a sense of which banks to support, according to the Milken Institute's James Barth.
Do they seize the institution, put the institution in conservatorship, or liquidate the institution? Or does the Treasury Department say, we're going to inject capital into this institution, or not?
And potential private investors in banks will also scrutinize the test results, says John Douglas.
The more knowledge that the private sector has about the true condition of a bank, the more likely the private sector is to invest. And our banking system will only recover once private capital starts coming back into these institutions in a serious way.
And government regulators say that's just what they're aiming for. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
So the country's big banks are working out their balance sheets and getting ready for their turn on the Treasury's treadmill, but not Citigroup. It's decided to skip the test and go straight to intensive care. Last night, the bank went to the government and admitted it needs what amounts to a heart bypass in the banking world. It's the third time in 6 months that Citi has gone under the government knife or at least asked for a transfusion. Ashley Milne-Tite reports on why the bank needs surgery this time and what form the operation could take.
Citigroup's problems are a good example of what banks could face if they fail the Treasury stress test. Bart Natter is head of the banking group at consulting firm Celent. He says Citi was already in trouble, but the faltering economy has put it in danger of collapse.
I think that as part of the TARP program, Citi was forced to stress test their portfolio and re-examine it. And I think when they re-examined it, they got some surprises.
Think of a bank's balance sheet like a seesaw. On one side is all the money the bank owes to bondholders, to other banks and creditors. On the other side are its cash or equity and its assets. Because many of those assets, like those infamous mortgage-backed bonds, are worth little or nothing, the seesaw is way out of balance. To level things up, Citi needs more cash. And the $45 billion in Citi preferred stock that the government owns could be the solution. Peter Cohen is a consultant who writes widely about banks. He says right now that preferred stock is structured almost like debt. If it converts to common stock, it turns into an asset for Citigroup.
They reduce the debt and they boost up the tangible common equity, which makes it possible for Citi to have a much stronger balance sheet from the perspective of the regulatory requirements, particularly in light of these stress tests.
Converting to common stock would mean the taxpayer wouldn't have to pay any more money, at least for now. Tom Higgins is chief economist at Payden & Riegel Asset Management. He says there's only one word for this.
The government doesn't want to call it nationalization, but effectively that is the direction that we're moving in.
And that could mean we'd be stuck owning a large chunk of a bank that might never recover. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Look, we'd like to write the ending to this story, preferably a happy one, as much as you'd like to hear us tell it. But we haven't even reached the page that actually defines what form nationalization, if it's deemed necessary, might take. Consider the comment a Marketplace listener posted to our website. He argues the model for this type of recovery has been used successfully since the 1930s to, quote, take over, not nationalize, bad banks. Okay, so what's the difference between a takeover and nationalization? Josh Rosner is on the line from New York. He's managing director at the research firm Graham Fisher. Hi, Mr. Rosner.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. So when we talk about some banks seemingly moving closer to nationalization, I think the image that a lot of people get is of some Latin American despot taking over some industry. What would nationalization mean in your eyes?
Well, look, I mean, it certainly can be anything from that to something a lot more benign. I would argue and point out that the FDIC nationalizes banks on a regular basis. Actually, it's increasingly seeming like Thursday and Fridays are nationalization days, where they essentially go in and they take over the depository institution, either through an open market save where they strip out the bad assets and find a strategic buyer for the good ones, or by taking over the institution, winding it down, working off the obligations, and then selling the healthy assets to the living.
Do we need to be careful about the terminology that we're using here? Is it nationalization or is it something else?
Well, no, I think that it's actually resolving. I think it's the resolution. I don't think that it's nationalization. It's essentially restructuring. And you got to remember, I mean, one might argue that that's the process that happens every time there's a bankruptcy of an institution in this country.
Temporary receivership, perhaps?
Exactly right, or conservatorship or something to that end. What we have now is actually really the half dead.
Now, does this get into a question of semantics here? Because in the case of Citigroup, for example, we're talking about the government buying more Citigroup stock. That, in essence, is a percentage of nationalization, is it not?
The approach that we're hearing is, frankly, a neither nor. I don't think it's going to be very effective by way of an approach. I don't think it ultimately will resolve anything. And ironically, it seems unlikely that even if we did end up with, let's say, the 40% ownership of Citi that is rumored, the government would probably not vote its shares. I would think that actually we really at some point need to stop treating the equity holders like there's any value, because I think when all is said and done, there isn't really any equity value in this company left.
Now, is this the problem in the stock market right now, that a lot of people don't know just how far the government intends to go here?
I think that's the problem. I think, frankly, the government has cast itself in a very dangerous position where it's made, you know, implicit promises to various classes of investors, leading those investors to believe that there are lines that the government won't cross. And at the end of the day, I think that's driven us to actually treat, as example, all banks as though they've got the same problems. If you don't draw the line in the sand between healthy and unhealthy, living and dead, then frankly investors really don't know how to invest. And unfortunately, that is where we are today. Now, I think it's also, by the way, very important that we get this message out that we need to make sure that people who have their money in these banks understand that even if the banks were, quote-unquote, nationalized, taken over, put in receivership, that the depositors are actually okay. And so, you know, part of, I think, what's a responsible approach at this point is for depositors to actually, people who have accounts at these banks, to not worry about their money unless they're over that $250,000 limit. Depositors need to actually understand that they're helping the situation. If they are under the FDIC limits and leave their money where it is, they'll be okay.
Josh Rosner is managing director at the research firm Graham Fisher. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
As we've mentioned, Wall Street demonstrated again today how much it hates the uncertainty of all this. The details when we do the numbers. Don't worry. B-U-Y, happy. Buy happy. A lot of retailers are doing what they can to help you stop worrying about the risk that you might lose your job just when you've gone out on the limb and made that big purchase. So some big-ticket items are now coming with a guarantee to keep your payments current. The offers come under such names as Mortgage Protection Plan or Auto Payment Relief Plan. They're aimed at taking some uncertainty out of these uncertain economic times. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
You may have heard this ad recently.
Now finance or lease any new Hyundai. And if you lose your income in the next year, return it to us with no impact on your credit.
Hyundai recently added another sweetener. If you lose your job, they'll cover your loan payments for up to 3 months, meaning you keep the car. Toll Brothers, the luxury home builder, meanwhile, has just announced that if you get laid off, they'll cover your mortgage payment, up to $2,500 for 6 months. Economist Edward Lehmer follows the housing market for the UCLA Anderson Forecast.
Relieving the anxieties of buyers is extremely useful because we are clearly underbuying and underbuilding homes, and it all has to do with fear of the future.
But Lehmer says the main anxiety buyers face isn't job loss. It's that their new house will be worth less in 6 months.
I would encourage these firms to offer some kind of price guarantee as well. For most prospective home buyers right now, prices are the biggest problem and not necessarily the rise in unemployment.
Lehmer suggests that builders promise to cover any price decline for a new home that exceeds, say, 10% of the purchase price. And consumer advocate Pedro Marias of CalPERG warns, beware of relying too heavily on any job loss protection program to pay the bills.
When you go into something like this, don't assume that because you qualify for the loan, you qualify for the insurance program that these folks are offering. The devil is sort of in the details.
For instance, Toll Brothers won't pay your mortgage if you're self-employed or own part of the company, or if you lose your job due to misconduct, disability, or hospitalization. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Now the latest in our occasional series, Close to Home. We've been taking a look at how two very different towns, one here in California and one in Minnesota, are faring in the recession. Today, we take you back to Southern California's Temecula Valley. It's a collection of fast-growing suburbs just northeast of San Diego, and while much of the development is new, the area also has deep and lucrative ties to the Old West. Some of that history is now in peril. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas looks at the valley's effort to hang on to its rich past in the midst of an uncertain economic future.
If someone tells you, hey, meet me in Temecula, chances are you'll wind up here. This is Old Town, though it's not so easy to tell. Modern structures fashioned after century-old saloons and banks nestle alongside the real thing. Colorful old mercantile buildings and barns turned into upscale eateries and trendy shops. There's even a windmill or two.
If you look up here, that's what it's built out of. So it's just that stacked.
Rick Lee gives me a tour of the 100-year-old adobe building he bought a few years ago. It's a former trading post turned boutique. He sells fancy gifts for the home and some women's apparel. Old traditions, new opportunities is a favorite town slogan, but new opportunities are drying up.
It just seems like it really has died off big time as far as the home decor and stuff like that. You know, we're going to have to make some changes real soon.
A few years ago, Lee wanted to knock down the old trading post and build something new, like a restaurant. But local historians like Rebecca Farnbach convinced him that history can pay off.
We want to maintain this not only for our own history and to save it, but because of the tourist destination, so that people won't be disappointed when they come down here and they drive in from L.A. or wherever.
In good times, a couple million people visit the Valley's wine country and historic downtowns every year. But these aren't good times for old town merchants like Lee. He's trying to sell expensive home decor in an area plagued by foreclosures. So Lee is toying with that restaurant idea again. Tourists haven't given up on lunch, or he may lose the place. Then Old Town could start feeling more like Ghost Town. I'm at Vale Ranch, a 4.5-acre spread dotted with some of the oldest buildings in Temecula. All are slated for restoration.
In the old barn, we're looking for a wine store. Hopefully we'll have a couple of retail stores, galleries or antique stores, and there'll be some history displays.
Jerry Tessier is the developer and contractor. He says people think historic renovation isn't worth it.
I think there's a higher value to historic projects because they have a sense of uniqueness and character that better attracts tenants and customers and clients to those projects.
But with a frozen credit market, Tessier can't raise the $6 million needed to start this project. It's the same story for other landmark buildings across the Temecula Valley. 10 miles north of Vale Ranch, in the town of Wildomar, you come upon a site right out of an Andrew Wyeth painting. In a wide field of amber grass, a pale blue tower sits alongside a rambling farmhouse. Its white brocade curtains, they're actually painted onto sheets of plywood.
Looks like it's occupied. It's actually just plywood with windows painted on.
City Councilman Bob Cashman helped save the buildings from demolition and had them moved to this open field. The landowner wanted to make him the star attraction of yet another old town shopping district.
Because of the economy, that's not going to happen right now. So as land's for sale.
If and when the land is sold, the buildings could be demolished unless local historians again step in to save them. Right now, they can't afford to. But Temecula preservationist Daryl Farnbach says none of these projects has to happen overnight.
This is a recession. It's temporary. We're going to come out of it. So we're in it for the long haul.
The history buffs are confident they can weather the hard times. It's not so clear if the Temecula Valley's historic buildings can do the same. In Temecula, California, I'm Stephen Cuevas for Marketplace.
Coming up, Italy banks on the quality of its cheese.
Then a part of it is sold when it's 14 months, so quite young, and a part of it is sold at 24 months.
But first, let's do the numbers. A sell-a-thon on Wall Street pushed markets into territory today they haven't visited since 1997. The Dow Industrials scraped away another 3.4%, or 250 points, to close at 7114. The Nasdaq dropped 3.7%, or 53 points, to end at 1387. The S&P 500 retreated 3.5%, or 26 points. It finished at 743. For once, financial stocks weren't to blame. News that the government may increase its stake in Citigroup actually helped send shares up 9.75% after a loss of more than 35% for Citigroup on Friday. Bank of America also hit hard last week, deposited more than 3%. Wells Fargo banked more than 1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, helping more than 250,000 small businesses and nonprofits succeed using email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Constant Contact, a smart way to reach your customers. American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue, fresh thinking on the moral, spiritual, and ethical aspects of the economic downturn. Gain perspective at speakingoffaith.org. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, President Obama will address a joint session of Congress. A Senate committee discusses the Ticketmaster Live Nation merger. What does it mean for consumers and the future of the concert business? And events in New Orleans and around the world mark Fat Tuesday, or Mardi Gras, or Carnival, or in the United Kingdom, Pancake Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. Don't bother stopping me if you heard this one before. The government has some new ideas for shoring up the nation's banking system. President Obama has promised that taxpayer money going to banks in the next round must be passed on to provide credit to businesses and individuals. But the plan to commit more than $1.5 trillion more in public and private funds is short on details so far. So how do we make sure we won't have to live through Groundhog Day all over again? Commentator Ben Barber has an idea.
Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner has offered a second phase bank bailout plan that is mostly carrots and no sticks. Trouble is, without sticks, the banks are likely to figure out how to hang on to the big bucks the way they did the first time around last fall. So here's another proposal that no free market zealot can object to. Vouchers. That's right, let's submit the banks to the privatizing discipline of vouchers to which schools have been made to submit. Give the banks the big bucks, but leave them no choice but to, well, pass the bucks, onto you and me. Sort of like food stamps, you gotta spend them on food. It won't be the dreaded feds, but the banks that will negotiate and administer the loans. But they will have to work with federal vouchers that can be redeemed only when they are credited to a client who has obtained a home mortgage or car loan or business credit. Sorry, Mr. Bank CEO, but the vouchers can't be used to pay salaries or bonuses and are not redeemable for merger and acquisition deals. And if we put a shelf life of, say, 3 to 6 months on them, these vouchers can't be held in a vault as insurance against future debts and losses when those packages of bad debt are finally opened and evaluated. With vouchers, the banks will have a simple choice. Use them or lose them. So there it is. The banks get the vouchers, but we the people get the cash. Because the cash is available only when a loan is approved and the banks pass on the dough to those real folks who, as credit recipients, can get the real economy moving again. And hey, with vouchers, the government can truly pass the buck without worrying that the buck will stop with the banks. And Tim Geithner can relax because nobody will be able to call him a bank nationalizer or accuse Larry Summers of socialist leanings.
Benjamin Barber is a distinguished senior fellow at Demos in New York City. His most recent book is called Consumed. We invite your thoughts at marketplace.org. It helps to be a big cheese if you hope to have financial influence these days. And here's a case in point. The Italian government came to the rescue recently when the country's Parmesan cheesemakers took a sales hit. Officials decided to buy up hundreds of thousands of pounds and then give it away to charity, which goes to show the kind of value Italians put on their Parmesan. In fact, there's a bank in northern Italy that sees stockpiling the cheese as a way to hedge against losses. Megan Williams reports on the big wheels behind the region's money lending.
The Credem Bank in the tiny northern Italian town of Castelfranco Emilia. It could pass for any branch of any bank, any place in the world. Friendly, small, and bustling. But what makes this bank different is what's in the warehouse out back. 150,000 wheels of Parmesan cheese, with another 300,000 stored nearby, each worth up to $3,000. It's collateral for loans made to producers of the world-famous Parmigiano Reggiano Parmesan cheese. Bank manager Paolo Beni says the system's as safe as it gets.
Because we house the collateral here, it means that our risk is very small, so the interest we charge to the Parmesan producers is lower. If the producers cannot pay back the loan, we can simply sell the cheese we have in storage and recoup our losses.
In the warehouse, cheese the size of tractor wheels is stacked 20 shelves high, row after row. The bank doesn't just store it, though. It inspects it as well and downgrades any cheese that doesn't meet the strict standards.
The point is that all the cheese must be aged minimum 12 months.
Michele Abizzani is with the family-run organic Parmesan producer Casearia di Sant'Anna. It churns out 12,000 wheels of the cheese each year, more than half the organic Parmesan on the world market. He's here to check on his 19,000 wheels of cheese kept here.
Then a part of it is sold when he's 14 months, so quite young, and a part of it is sold at 24 months.
Nearby is Andrea Brucone, the bank's expert on the aging and classification of Parmesan. He stands over a huge wheel of cheese, wielding a little steel hammer. As he taps, Brucone listens intently for air bubbles or rot caused by mold.
This is wood. It's okay? Uh-huh. Okay?
Not
okay.
Not okay.
Questo è un difetto che non si toglie.
Ah, so this is a defective
si, si.
Parmesan wheel.
Si, si.
This wheel flunks the test, so Brucone lifts it onto a round platform and pushes a button. Steel forks dig into the sides of the cheese and scrape off the Parmigiano Reggiano imprint. It'll be sold as ordinary table cheese at a 15% discount. So the cheese is spinning around on a wheel. It looks like a potter's wheel. Like so many other gourmet foods, Parmesan sales are hurting with the economic crisis, and the Italian government has had to help out by buying up 150,000 wheels. But bank manager Bendi says by keeping its eyes and ears on the collateral, the bank can avoid the kind of risks that have brought other banks to the point of collapse. And just in case you were wondering, there are no derivatives on Parmesan.
Credo proprio di no, almeno su questo.
No, thank goodness. No Parmesan derivatives. At least we don't have that problem.
In Castelfranco Emilia, northern Italy, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, maybe you've noticed packages and portions getting smaller while the price has stayed the same. Those skimpy ice cream cartons, for example, that no longer give you a full half gallon. Well, it seems more consumers have been finding a better value in store-label alternatives, and the big brands have taken notice. The Wall Street Journal reports today that Heinz has increased the size of its ketchup bottles, so you'll see a bigger container for a similar price sitting next to the private label offering. Likewise, Frito-Lay, which plans to add 20% more to bags of chips without increasing the price. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 250 points, 3.4%. The Nasdaq fell 53 points, 3.75%. The S&P 500 dropped 26 points, 3.5%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, retail vacancies spell opportunity for some.
You're going to see people have different uses that come into box stores that normally you wouldn't consider 2 years ago.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Thank you.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.